I know that when it comes to Parshat Truma, there are many things in people's minds as far as, is the Mishkan a response somehow to the Egel, or is it not a response, to what extent it is or isn't? And I do want to take the approach of the Ramban today. And, you know, as I've said and as we've seen, the Ramban is somebody who believes that there is, in fact, chronological integrity, unless there's explicit information otherwise. And over here, the Ramban starts off in the beginning of Parshat Truma. I'll read to you a little bit, because most of you do not have this. The Ramban says as follows: Kasher diber Hashem im Yisrael panim b'fanim aseret ha-dibrot. When God spoke, and He said the aseret ha-dibrot, v'tziva otam yedei Moshe k'tzat mitzvot shehim kamo avot l'mitzvotah shel Torah. And God commanded Moshe some of the commandments which are the avot. And that's very interesting that the Ramban uses the word avot, because we know that, let's say, for the laws of Shabbat, there's avot melachot and toladot. There are primary, I would call them, and then there are expansions of these. And apparently that's what the Ramban is telling us, is that one could look at the mitzvot in Mishpatim. He doesn't say that clearly right here. One can look at the mitzvot in Mishpatim as being the expansions of the Aseret HaDibrot. The Aseret HaDibrot are the 10 primary, not the 10 most important mitzvot, but they are mitzvot where they're chapter headings. And then you have many, many details that fit within those chapter headings. He continues and he says, Ka'asher hinhigu rabotenu im hagerim shaba'im lehityahed. And this is similar to, and this is something that we did see last time, this is similar to the way the rabbis would speak to a potential convert who wants to lehityahed, who wants to become a Yehudi, lehityahed, somebody who wants to convert. The Yisrael kiblu aleim lasot kol ma shetziv, and the Jews accepted upon themselves everything that would be commanded through Moshe. The karati mahambrit, and he made a covenant with them, al kol zeh, on all of this. Me'ata heina him lo la'am, from this point on, they now became the people of God. V'hu lahem le'elohim, God came for them, a Lord. Kasher hitnei imahim mitchila, as he had initially made the covenant with them. V'yata im shamo atishmu b'koli u'shmartim priti v'yitim li skula v'amar v'atem tiyuli mamlechet konim v'goy kadosh. As God had said to Moshe, to say to the people, prior to the Aseret HaDibrot, that we're making a covenant. I will be for you a God, and you will be for me a nation of priests and a holy nation. V'nehem kedoshim ru'uyim sheyeh behem mikdash lashrot shchinato b'nehem. And because they're holy, they're worthy to have a sanctuary and to have God's presence upon them. U'lechein tzivat chila al dvar ha-mishkan shilo bayit b'tocham mikudash l'shmo. And therefore, one of the first commandments that they're told of is to create the sanctuary, this house among them, which will be sanctified in God's name. Vishami deber im Moshe, and there God will speak to Moshe, v'yitzaved b'nei Israel, and command the children of Israel, v'nei ikar hachafetz b'mishkan hu, makom minuchat hashchina shehu aron. The primary reason for this mishkan is to have a place to put the Luchot. Now, I want to pause for a second. The Ramban understands that things flow very clearly. There's actually two elements that I want to point out in what he's saying. One was, and I hope you picked this up, it would have been better to have the visual to see the words because I bolded them, but one is the preponderance of the word Kedusha, holiness. He kept using the word holiness along the way. You are holy people, and because you're holy, you should have holiness among you, and so on and so forth. Now, the word holiness is something which, you know, for a lot of us would practically be synonymous with religion, or synonymous with Judaism, or synonymous with the Torah. Although, and we're going to hold off on this for a moment or two till we get to the second point, but I would ask you to start to think, how many times was the word holy actually used in the Torah till this point? Or for that matter, does the word holiness, or does the concept of holy, appear at all in Sefer Bereshit? As you know, as much as you say, okay, Judaism is about holiness, well, is there any holiness in Sefer Bereishit as a whole? Certainly Vayikra, we find a great deal of holiness. What did I call my book on Vayikra? Something about holiness, right? So I could talk about. I wrote the book on holiness, so I can certainly talk about this. But the Ramban is saying no. The holy starts now. Now, first he's dealing. Yeah.
What about the word Tamar is described?
Okay, the word good there. It's not there. The word Kadesha is used.
Okay.
Question is, what is a Kadesha? So it's quite possible or probable that there's a difference between a Kadesha versus a Zonah. Although, if you notice the narrative over there, Yehuda keeps thinking of her as a Zonah, while his friend refers to her as a Kadesha. So the question is, are those the same or not? There are those who suspect that a Kadesha may actually be some kind of prostitution, but having something to do with some kind of idolatry. So therefore, to be a holy harlot would be better than just to be a... Correct. But having to do with the cultic activity. So that would be perhaps a suspicion. But again, before we start talking about Bereishit, the Ramban over here is drawing the line to holiness, and he starts off, he says, okay, God made a covenant that you are to be a holy people. So again, I want you just to realize that we take that for granted, but go back to the various dialogues between God and Avraham and Yitzhak and Yaakov. And again, they are told, I am going to give you the land of Israel, right? The word holy, as far as I recall, is not used in any of those discussions. Now, of course, you could say, but okay, of course, Avraham was holy, but still, I'm just pointing out the word holy is not there. Now, the Ramban sees a line over here. And the line he's going to tell us afterwards, in the next paragraph, he's going to say, "V'sod hamishkanhu," and there's this. He uses the word "sod," which I would be tempted to say mystical secret, or undercurrent, or not necessarily obvious to us. For the Ramban, the Ten Commandments, as he already told us, are the chapter headings of Judaism. The Ten Commandments have within them holiness. Why do they have holiness? So I can say one of two possibilities. One is because God said them, or two, because of the content. So again, that's always the tension. Is it the fact that God said it, or is it the content of what God said? Or if you want, you can say both. But nonetheless, there is revelation at Har Sinai. The content of the revelation is the Ten Commandments. Moshe is going to go up to the mountain and bring down the Ten Commandments etched on stone. When he comes down, we have a problem. Now, this is maybe not the first thing that you ever thought of, but we have a problem when he comes down. Of course, he solves the problem temporarily the first time he comes down by shattering the Luchot, but he nonetheless has a problem. And that problem is, what do you do with the Luchot? Where do you put Luchot? Where do you put something which has such a level of holiness to them? That's not such a simple thing. I remember, you know, it was one time that we had an Achnasat Sefer Torah that I had arranged for. But this Torah, we actually had to take it out of the country for a bar mitzvah, the person who had dedicated it, and we brought it back. And do you know what it's like having a Torah in your house? Again, I just don't know if you ever thought about it. You know, it's like traveling with the Torah. Thank God it was El Al, so at least they were... And in the airport in Israel, they were wonderful. They were wonderful. Could just walked us through security, and they're absolutely... We could have had a bomb with us. I mean, it was... They were absolutely great, but even putting it on the plane, where do you put it on? I'm just saying, having something which is holy is actually something which is very daunting. And okay, so Moshe comes down, he's got the Luchot, now what do you do with them? So as far as the Ramban is concerned, don't bother me with the golden calf, and don't bother me that the Jews may have needed something concrete or something to worship. He's not concerned with any of that. Direct line, revelation, content, Ten Commandments. Moshe goes up, brings down the Ten Commandments. Now you have a problem. Solution to the problem? You need a place which is holy in order to house that which is holy. Which means, as far as he's concerned, the purpose of the Mishkan is one of utility, and the utility is in order to house something which is holy. And he'll point out over here, if you notice, the first thing which is discussed is actually the building of the ark, and it says the ark, you're going to place the tablets which I'm going to give you. So if that's the case, and of course the bigger question may be, if you were not the Ramban, would is this the first time Moshe goes up, the second time that he goes up? But the Ramban would be completely convinced this is the first time he goes up, it's before any sin of the golden calf. God is saying to him, you're going to come down, you're going to have the luchot, you need to do something with the luchot, then that's why you need to build a sanctuary, which means, again, it's one of pure utility. But now you realize that the revelation at Sinai morphs into the necessity for having a place to put the luchot. And again, as simple as that. So therefore, the Ramban now is going to continue and say, well, it's even more than that. And just one more piece of evidence. Because normally, what you would have said is build the Mishkan, right? Build the Mishkan, and then all of the details should have been how to build the structure. And after you're finished with building the structure, then there should have been a commandment to build the various furniture or things which go inside the structure. But over here, it's the other way around. First comes the Aron, the Ark, then the structure. So the Ramban is saying, well, that's quite obvious then. So what is the main purpose over here? The main purpose is actually to build some place to put the Luchot. Yeah. I'm not sure. Now, the Ramban then continues and he tells us that the reality is that the holiness of the Mishkan is the same holiness that was at Mount Sinai. So therefore, what the Ramban is going to tell us, that the holiness of Sinai somehow transforms into the holiness of the Mishkan, and eventually the holiness of the Mishkan is going to make its way to Israel and become the holiness of Jerusalem and the holiness of the Temple Mount. All that is going to flow directly. So therefore, as we can say today, Ki Mitzion Teitze Torah, Dvar Hashem Yushalayim, that from Zion the Torah should come forth. Well, where did the Torah actually come forth from? The Torah came forth from Sinai. So what are you talking about? Well, then you realize that no, that Sinai and the Temple Mount are the same place. Now, of course, that's preposterous, because the Sinai and the Temple Mount are not the same place. Which leads us to a second point. I brought up this issue of holiness, and to what extent holiness is manifest in the Torah till this point. Don't worry, we will see all the times that hopefully, B'li Neder, that holiness is manifest until this point. The remarkable thing is that for a short amount of time, Sinai was the holiest location on the place of this earth, and it lost that status, I would say, almost immediately. And you would have thought, again, here's where you have holiness of space. I mean, holiness, you know, if we have such demarcations, as it were, of time, space, and matter, then apparently holiness can be affixed to time and to space and to matter. And you can have holy time, you can have holy places, and you can have holy things. And if you start thinking about the Mishkan is actually taking gold and silver and brass and turning these things into holy. It's taking precious stones and turning all these things, taking animal skins and turning all these objects into holiness. And all these objects, which in and of itself are basically unexciting and neutral, again, not holy, not holy, not special, not special, and it's turning them into something which is holy. So the building of the Mishkan is creating holiness of matter, correct? We can also, as I said, speak of holiness of time or holiness of space. So holiness of time, we're going to find that there is holiness of time before this, which is mentioned. What's more intriguing is the holiness of space. So Sinai becomes a place which is holy, but completely loses that holiness, as I said, almost immediately. It retains its holiness for a short amount of time. We today really don't care where Mount Sinai is. We don't know where it is. We have no tradition about it. We don't know within 500 miles where it is. No, again, just think about that. Within 500 miles, I could be more than 500. We know where it is. Right. Had anybody else made any other suggestions?
Yeah.
Okay. But the reality, as what I said is reality, we've kept no tradition about it, which means to go backwards and to try to point at it, people have tried. And I've seen various suggestions over the years where people think it is. But the important thing is almost immediately it lost its status. So whatever holiness was there was temporary. The Ramban claims that the holiness of Mount Sinai gets transferred into the Mishkan. And as soon as the Mishkan is built, now the Mishkan has that holiness. And then as they travel, the Mishkan retains the holiness and Sinai has lost the holiness. But again, I'll follow that idea all the way through till the time that the temple is finally built. When the temple is finally built, now that same holiness is there. I once mentioned a midrash, which is a very strange midrash. It says that when God made Mount Sinai, what he did is that, you know, the same way that when a woman separates challah from the dough, it says that God made the dough and took the challah from the dough and threw the challah in the desert, and that was Mount Sinai. And the rest of it was Jerusalem, which is such an interesting visual or suggestion. And then it says, but then afterwards, somehow Sinai will now revert and come back to Jerusalem. But again, what was this midrash trying to tell us? Forget about the literalness of it. What was it trying to tell us? Exactly. It's saying that Sinai and Jerusalem are the same holiness. And the reason you would say that, which is again, is the common denominator of Kimitzian Teitzei Torah Dvar Hashem Yushalayim, that Jerusalem eventually becomes the place, the locale, where the Torah flows from, so therefore the origin of this is Sinai. So again, the Midrash is trying to say they're the same place. As I said, even though on a geographic level, on a literal level, it's an absurdity, but that's nonetheless the Midrash's perspective. Yeah. Yes, I did say that.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So what happened when the Aron disappeared from the temple? Does that mean the holiness went with it?
What does the Shekhinah remain on the Temple Mount or not? Okay, so that is a worthy question. Apparently the answer is yes, that the Shekhinah remains there. That's a whole other talk. What happens when the first temple is destroyed? What happens when the second temple is destroyed? Are they the same? Did the same thing happen? Was it re-holy? Was it the original holiness? That, as I said, is a whole another discussion. Now, that is more or less what the Ramban is telling us over here. He will point out that on a literary level, there are various verses which describe the Mishkan and the completion of the Mishkan, which are essentially echoes of the description of Mount Sinai. And the cloud fills the place, and the cloud fills the place. And he's going to say, oh no, this literary connection is expressing a thematic connection. It's because they're actually, it is the same idea. And therefore, Sinai has the holiness, and then it moves on. Okay, so let's now move back to the first idea, and that is the idea of holiness. The first time that we find holiness, in the Torah is holiness of time. And that goes all the way back to Bereshit Perek Bet, Pasuk Gimel, which, not surprisingly, is a discussion of the Shabbat. Perek Bet, Pasuk Gimel, Vayevarech Elokim et Yom HaShviyi, Vayekadesh Oto. And God blessed the seventh day, and he sanctified it. By the way, that sanctity does not necessarily, at this point, meaning in Bereshit chapter 2, that sanctity does not necessarily have any human indication or ramification whatsoever. Which means, is this verse a theocentric verse? Or is this verse homocentric, or does it have anything to do with humans? Which means, and the answer is no. God created, God rested, God blessed. But nothing else. It's not until we get to the Ten Commandments that we say, and God commands us as well to take part, although we have the earlier section dealing with Mara. But as I said, go all the way through the rest of Bereshit, as much as I know that all of you know that Avram and Sarah and so on, they kept Shabbat. But of course, it's not just that there's no evidence they kept Shabbat. There's no significance of Shabbat from the human perspective, because the holiness of Shabbat is completely, completely a theocentric description. So here you have holiness of time, but either fortunately or unfortunately, the holiness of time has no human implication to it. So that's the first time that we do find holiness. Where's the next time that we find holiness? So it depends. It depends if I'm looking for the word holy. I don't believe it's any other time in Bereshit. If I'm looking for the concept of holiness, I do find it one other time in Bereshit. And that other time is in Bereshit chapter Kavchet, the beginning of Parshat Vayetze, when Yaakov goes and he lays down and he has his epiphany, and then when he wakes up, he says in Pasuk Yud Zayin, Kavchet Yud Zayin, Vayomer, Achen Yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh v'nochi lo yadati, there is God in this place and I didn't know it. Again, he didn't actually call the place holy, and then he writes Vayira, and he was frightened. Vayomer, Manu ra hamakom hazeh, and here we know that Yaakov was from California. What did he say? How awesome is this place, right? Ein zekiim beit elokim v'zeh shar shamayim. This is the house of God, and this is the gate toward heaven. Now, the fact that he's calling it a house of God is actually incredibly significant. Yaakov, not only does Yaakov call this a house of God, right afterwards he says, I am going to build a house for God. I'm going to build a... He doesn't use the word Mishkan. What word does he use? I'm going to build a bayit, right? Beit Elokim. I'm going to build a house for God. So again, I do want to point out that anybody who wants to come and tell me. Yes. Correct. Anybody who wants to tell me that the whole concept in Judaism of building a Mishkan or a Beit HaMikdash or a Beit Elokim is all based upon the Chet HaEgel, and man needed this and so on, I'll just say, well, Yaakov didn't have an Egel, and Yaakov has an epiphany, and Yaakov realizes that this is the place to connect to heaven, and Yaakov says, I'm going to build a house for God. And he says, Manu raha makom hazeh. Now, of course, it would be incredibly convenient if the place that Yaakov feels this is Jerusalem. That's, I think, somewhat harder to argue. It's called Beit El, it's called Luz, it's called all kinds of things. It's just not called Jerusalem necessarily, but Yaakov feels something over here. This is the only time in Bereshit that we find holiness articulated in terms of place, and there's one other exception which I will yet try to come back to. But over here, you can make the argument. Now, the one word which is missing from this whole thing, and now, by the way, going back to it, you say, hold it, how do they miss that word? How do they miss the word holy within this whole thing? It was awesome, it was incredible, a house for God. Every single word is there except for one word, and that is the word holy is somehow missing from it. So holy is only in Bereshit in context to holiness of time, in terms of Shabbat. Over here, we have the religious sensibility of Yaakov, who knows innately that a house of God is necessary and it's a good thing to do, and he makes a pledge. Whether he builds it or not is something else. This becomes a Jewish tradition afterwards. Okay, I'll leave. If you know the joke, and court costs, but okay. Yes, you know the joke. If not, you don't know it. There's a guy who, on Yom Kippur, there's the appeal, and one guy says, you know, I'll donate $100 or $1,000, and this guy says $100,000, and everybody goes crazy, and they give him an aliyah, they give him after Yonah, they make a dinner for him, whatever. He never gives the money. And And they wait and they wait and they wait and they wait, and he doesn't give the money. So finally the shul says, you know what, this is embarrassing. We gave him a dinner, we gave him after Yonah, we gave him this, and they sue him. They sue him, they take him to court, and he said publicly he's going to give the money, and the judge rules you have to give $100,000 plus the court costs. Anyway, the guy doesn't show his face in shul for many, many, many years. 15 years later, he shows up. There's an appeal. It's Yom Kippur, and someone says $100, $150, and he says $100,000, and everybody looks at him, and he goes, plus court costs. Okay, anyway, enough anti-Semitism. Let's, the next time we do find holiness in terms of space, but really holiness at all, is in source number 3, is when Moshe finds himself standing in front of a burning bush. And Moshe standing in front of the bush, over here it says in Pasuk Hey, Vayomer al tikrav, God says, Halom shal na'alecha me'al raglecha, take off your shoes from your feet, ki ha'makom asher ata omed alav admat kodeshu, the place where you're standing is holy ground, it's holy land. Here we have holiness of space expressed for the first time. Of course, what's the beautiful thing about this particular location? It says in Pasuk Aleph, what's the place called? The place is called Har Elokim Choreva. It's called Chorev. What is this place known as? Well, it's the burning bush. But what is this place known as? The place is known as Sinai. So the Medrash actually says the name Sinai, comes from the word Sneh. Sneh means bush. That what was the real name of the place? The real name of the place is Chorev, as it's called over here. But the revelation that Moshe has at Sinai, well, which revelation? Which means there's the micro and then there's the macro. There's the personal revelation and then there's the national revelation. So the micro personal revelation that Moshe has by the Sneh then becomes the macro revelation that the entire people have at Sinai. But the Sneh and Sinai are the same thing. Now, this is already much more significant because here we see that Sinai is a holy place. It's the only, again, it's the first place which is referred to as a holy place. This becomes a holy place. The holiness of Sinai, as I said, now according to the Ramban, then flows into the Mishkan and ends up back in Jerusalem, which, of course, according to the other Midrash, I said, where the holiness came to in the first place. Are there any other references to building a house for God or any other references to a Mishkan or to a Mikdash along the way? And the answer is, of course, yes. And again, all this I'm saying against those who claim that there was no, that the Mishkan is just this accident or the result of an accident. When we read through, and we're not going to read the whole thing now, but when we read through Source 4, which is Perek Yud Bet. Those of you who recall Perek Yud Bet, Perek Yud Bet is about the Korban Pesach. So in Egypt, we're supposed to bring an offering. By the way, here an offering, God says, I want you to bring an offering. And now he says, I want you to bring an offering. He says, you're going to do this every year. It's not a one-time thing. It's going to be continued time after time. Now, where is it going to be continued at? Which means, where is this going to take place? So here it actually leaves out what the place is, but it's very, very clear. Let's just see, for example. And by the way, holy, kadosh, is all over this section. Here you have holiness all over, but the vast majority of holiness refers to holiness of time. It's going to be a Mikra Kodesh. There's going to be a holy day. This will be a holy day throughout history. And holiness is introduced over here within the Passover, within the Korban Pesach, within the days called the Passover holiday, or Chag HaMatzot, if you will. If you look at Pasuk Kaf Hey, which is the very bottom of page 2, V'hayaki Tavo El Haaretz, when you come to the land, Asher Yitein Hashem Lachem, which God will give you, Kasher Diber, Ushmartim Et Avodah Hazot. This practice is going to be continued. V'hayaki Yomur Lecha B'neichem Avodah Hazot Lachem. People are going to ask you, V'yom Zevach Pesach Lashem. Again, the Korban Pesach is going to be something which will be done all the time. So over here we have holiness. The holiness refers to the time. We also have the offering. We're actually missing one thing. And I'm going to cut what? Yeah, exactly where you do it. And that's left in a far more amorphous way. You're going to do this, so where are you going to do it? That's not really clearly explained. Holiness is also found in source 5, which is a continuation of the Pesach story. Kadesh li kol b'chor. Right, you're going to make the firstborn holy, and this is as a remembrance to memory to leaving Egypt. Later on, we have a couple of references to holiness and a holy place, and it comes in perhaps what would be an unexpected place, and that is in the Shira, in Oz Yashia, the Song by the Sea. Now, for the most part, the Song of the Sea, for the most part, refers to the future and does not refer to the past. Yes, you've noted this after the first line. It's future oriented. In Pasuk Yud Aleph it says, "Mi kamocha be'elim Hashem, mi kamocha nedar b'kodesh, nerati lo tosef ele." That's holiness in terms of God, who is like God, who's holy like God, and so on. But then in Pasuk Yud Gimel it says, "Nachita b'chazdecha amzuga alta, nelta ba'azcha el nave kachacha." You're going to take us to the holy... Okay, so what exactly does the words Nave Kodshecha mean? What? El Nave Kodshecha.
An oasis of holiness.
Okay. Which is not as specific as we would like. So then you go on to the Pasuk Yud Zayin. Tivieimu vititaeinu bahar nachlatcha, machon l'shiftecha pa'alta Hashem, mikdash Hashem konenu yadecha. Which really speaks about creating a place which is holy, you know, in this holy place. It seems to be, again, one can argue these passages, but it sounds very much like the Oz Yashir is, again, looking towards the future, looking towards entering the land of Israel. The nations of Israel who are there right now will all run away. Those are the verses that we skipped. They're all going to run away. The Jews are going to get there, and they're going to then create this place of holiness, which does not sound like it's referring to all of the land of Israel as being holy, which, of course, we say it is, but it sounds much more as building a mikdash itself. Source 9. Preparation for Har Sinai, which really gets back to the essence. The Yomar Shem El Moshe, and this is really what the Ramban referred to, Perek Yutet in Shemot. The Yomar Shem El Moshe, Leich El Am, Vikidashtem Hayom Umachar, Vikipsu Simlatam. You're going to make yourselves holy to prepare for the revelation. But Yunachulim Yom HaShlishi, you prepared for 3 days and so on, and then God is going to appear. Vihigbaltem Et Am Saviv Lemar, and you're going to create limitations around the mountain. He shamru lechem, be careful, alot bahar, not to go up, ungoa bikatzeo, even touch the edge of it. Kol hanogea bahar mot yumatu, if it touches it, it's going to die. Again, lo tigabo, don't even touch it. So this prohibition against touching it is, of course, the implication of holiness. Because, you know, we've skipped over probably the most important thing. What does the word holiness mean? So, most likely, holiness means different. It means separate. It means unique. It means not everyday-like. So if Sinai is truly holy, so Sinai now, once it has its holiness, Moshe is told, take off your shoes. We're back by the snare. Now we're told not everybody can go and even touch the mountain because now it's holy. Which means the implication of holiness creates separateness. The place the commentaries talk about that much more is in Vayikra, by Kedoshim Tiyu, you shall be holy. So what does it mean to Kedoshim? Right? The Rashi writes Purushim Tiyu. It's great separateness. But over here as well, when we see holiness being articulated in terms of space, again, it's interesting. Yaakov is everything there except the word holy, but he realizes, it's, again, how awesome the place is. You know, Mano Ramakom is in. I was laying down there, which means Yaakov seems to sense that there's holiness there. As I said, just the word is missing. Over here, Moshe gets this holiness to this place. He has to take off his shoes. Now the same place, it's holy, and people just can't go and touch it. Now, what's interesting about the touching is back in Bereshit, which, by the way, may be the only other place in Bereshit where there was holiness in terms of place. Perhaps all of Gan Eden should be thought of as a holy place. So it's interesting, and again, you can argue with me about this. This is in Source 10, Bereshit Perek Gimel, where we have the dialogue between the serpent and between the woman. Right? Not to eat from every tree of the field. We can't eat. Not only can't you eat it, you can't even touch it. So the question is, to what extent is there a connection between the non-touching of this tree and the non-touching of Sinai? Now, of course, you're going to come and tell me, what are you talking about? God never said not to touch it. And this is this whole problem, where did the non-touching even come from? And all that I don't care about. No, I'll tell you the reason I don't care, is that it seems to be that she has a sense that this is separate. Again, the misrepresentation of the Nachash is he says we can't eat from every tree of the field. Of course, it's true. You can't eat from every tree because there's one tree you can't eat from. So you can't eat, it's true, you can't eat from every tree of the field. The serpent was a lawyer writing a contract. You can't eat from every tree of the field because there was one you couldn't eat from. And she says, no, there's just one that we can't eat from. So that's really what the dawn. But she says, this one is the one which is separate, and therefore this is the one which can't even be touched. So where this came from, if, again, in some sources it says that Adam misled her and he made a siag and he never should have gone and he added to his words and so on, all that doesn't concern me. What concerns me much more is there seems to be religious sensitivity over here that if this is a separate tree, this is a different tree, this is a tree that can't be used, that means that this really can't be touched. And it becomes very interesting that the same language then is used by Sinai. Actually, the person who was pushing me on this was my son Yishai, who was convinced that there is some connection, but he's right. I mean, the word lo tig'u is found in both places, and that would push us further to this perhaps some connection between the holiness of Sinai and the holiness, which may...
She's looked down upon for adding the tentacle. It's not. It wasn't a positive thing.
I said, I knew you were going to say that.
So you can't really compare.
Of course you can compare.
You can compare. It's not Sinai is from Hashem that it's holy.
First of all, there are those who question where it came from. And they don't look down on her, they look down on him. They blame Adam for perhaps adding it. And this is the first of many, many, many rabbinic enactments. So adding to what God said, adding to it, and it didn't seem to work out all that well. So my point is not... Excuse me?
He said wait 7 hours,
right. I said don't eat... Okay, anyway. What I'm getting to is not how it worked out. The issue is the religious sensitivity to realize that when something is separate or holy, that it's not even touched. Okay, would you rather call this as the starting point for laws of muksa? Which, of course, you all know the laws of muksa means you're allowed to touch it, you're just not allowed to move it. But it's funny, because everyone thinks you can't touch it. It's muksa, you can't touch it. You're allowed to touch muksa. You just can't move muksa. But everyone... See that? It was worth coming just for that. There is no law that you can't touch something which is muksa. Although if you touch something muksa, if someone's going to see him, that's muksa. No, you can't move something which is muksa. You're allowed to touch something which is muksa. Now, okay, I'm sorry I said that. I never should have revealed such rabbinic secrets to you. But over here, the non-touching that Eve articulates later on, whether you like it or not, it is the same religious sensitivity which the Torah actually commands us regarding, and by the way, only regarding Mount Sinai. Of course, later on, the holiness of the mountain is going to become the holiness of the Mishkan, and not everybody can go there. And the holiness of the Mishkan is the holiness of the temple, and not everybody can go there. And the holiest part within it, not everybody can go there. So just like only Moshe is allowed to actually go to the place which is holy, so therefore if I were to say okay, they're all going to become a kingdom of priests, okay, that was just now articulated, they're all going to become a kingdom of priests. Who's the high priest during Matan Torah? It's not Aaron. The high priest during Matan Torah is Moshe. And as Sinai becomes, the Mishkan becomes the Beit HaMikdash, now the Holy of Holies can only be approached by the Kohen Gadol and not by the Moshe, not by the Talmud Chacham, it's Moshe functioning as a Kohen Gadol. How interesting is it then that Moshe comes down bringing the second Luchot on which day? On Yom Kippur. Why? Because Yom Kippur is connected to Matan Torah. Of course, like the Kohen Gadol, the radiance like the Kohen Gadol. Okay. Okay. The other thing that should connect us back to the Garden of Eden in terms of the whole Mishkan and the Aron and the Luchot is, of course, source 11, is that once they're sent away from Garden of Eden, Vayishlacheu Hashem Elokim migan Eden, la'avod et adamah shelukach misham, vigaresh et adam, vayashken mikedem lagan Eden et akruvim. You can't ignore now the word vayashken. It's such an interesting word to have used here. What does the word vayashken mean? What does the word mean, vayashken? He caused it to do vayashken, but you see the word shchina there, you see the word mishkan there, vayashken mikedem lagan Eden. What did he put east of Eden? Et akruvim. And what is the role of the kruvim? In order to guard the path to Eitz Chaim. Of course, the Eitz Chaim literally means the tree of life, but later on we're going to learn in Mishle that the tree of life refers to the Torah, which is why on many Aron Kodesh it says Eitz Chaim hi l'machzikim ba, or even the wood, I don't know if you know this, the wood which is on the Torah is actually called an Eitz Chaim. Called the Eitz Chaim. Eitz Chaim is connected to Torah. So over here, and as I said, it's a verse in Mishle. Eitz Chaim the Machzikimba is a verse in Mishle. The Torah is a tree of life to those who embrace it or hold on to it. So over here, it's fascinating because the Kruvim guard the path to where the Eitz Chaim is and what, of course, is going to happen in the Mishkan. We're going to be told to create Kruvim, which are going to guard the Aron, which means over here we have... Again, if we sense that the holiness somehow went from the burning bush to Sinai to the Mishkan, we just now are enabled to perhaps stretch this a little bit further, going all the way back to perhaps the holiness which existed in the Garden of Eden, including the tree which shouldn't be touched. Now, of course, you're going to say, this is the problem with holiness. But I just want to say one more thing about this. One more thing about the tree of knowledge of good and evil and the serpent. And because, of course, you can, again, I don't know, Shuli's already intimidated. She doesn't want to yell at me again. You're going to say this is completely different. And what does one thing have to do with the other? You know, this is the holiness and this is the tree of knowledge of good and evil and the serpent and trying to get us and sin. And if you want to go into original sin and all kinds of other things like that. But there is, again, a fascinating Gemara that talks about when the rabbis prayed to take away the desire for idolatry and later the desire for other things, but it describes as a scream coming out from the Holy of Holies, which means the evil inclination, as it were, is actually something which is very holy. Of course, what makes it holy? It needs to be rejected. It needs not to be touched, which means the rejection of it is something which is holy as well. But I don't want to go any further in that. I'm just saying is that even though, again, you may think that this is my imagination getting the best of me, seeing somehow any kind of connection between Eden and Sinai, nonetheless, here you potentially have holy grounds one. Two, you have the word not to touch it, which is in both cases. Over here, you have the kruvim, which is the strongest argument. You have the kruvim guarding the path, and later on, the kruvim are going to guard the temple. But I'm pointing. But you're going to say, but it's completely inappropriate because this is something which is the tree that shouldn't be eaten. So that also comes from a holy place, which means God is the one who gives us both the good inclination and the evil inclination. You know, we say in Shema, b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha ma'odecha. So b'chol nafshecha is a very strange word. Is that where it gets it from? From b'chol levavecha, right? It should have said b'chol libcha, with your whole heart. What's b'chol livvavecha? So it says you both your yetzahara and yetzer tov. You should serve God with both. Okay, and how exactly do you serve? No, the point is that the yetzer tov is holy and the yetzer hara is also holy. The problem is when you let the yetzer hara end up taking control. And all that I'll say is there's a lot more to talk about this, but we'll leave it for the Freudians to complete the discussion of the holiness. Because again, that's really what that whole Gemara was talking about. It's also the undercurrent in terms of Sinai. Let's continue a little bit more. As we move to Sinai, we have, again, holiness of time, the Shabbat, Zochorot Yom HaShabbat, LeKadsho. And at this point, what was previously a theocentric perspective now becomes a human obligation as well. Now the Shabbat becomes man's obligation. In Parshat Mishpatim, and now here I'm getting involved in a problem, and the problem is, when was Mishpatim said? But again, we're just following the Ramban today, so that means that this was said at which juncture? This was said before, right? Arguably before Moshe goes up.
No, Ramban has it after Mishpatim. When was Mishpatim said, or the part after?
Right, but it's before Moshe goes up at the end of Mishpatim. It's after Aseret HaDibro, but before Moshe goes up for 40 days. So over here, it's certainly before, shall we say, it's certainly before everything else. Over here, just for example, in Source 13, Anshe Kodesh Tiyun Li. So again, you should be holy people for me. What's the implication of being holy? You don't eat everything. And over here, we have, again, one of the first Kashrut laws. Again, we had two prior to this. But here, the laws of Kashrut, not to eat something which is called treif. Treif is actually a technical thing. It's a carcass. Man, we should tell him about your cat. No, it's what's worse than a dead cat?
I have a dead cat.
A dead cat in your engine, but okay. Anyway, did they feel bad for you or for the cat? Okay. V'anshe kodesh tiyun li, you should be holy people, u'basar b'sadeh tereifa lo tochlu, l'kelov tashlichun oto. Right. Okay. The other, this is probably, okay, look also at source 19 right now. No, not even source 19 yet, sorry. Let's look first at source 17. Verse 17 is immediately after Aseret HaDibrot. It talks about building a Mizbeach. Which means, again, you can think or speak of a Mizbeach being independent of the Mishkan, but I think for a lot of people, it's actually the Mizbeach is the most disturbing part of the Mishkan. Over here, Mizbeach Adam, it talks how you make a Mizbeach. What an altar should be made of. In Perikuf Aleph, when it talks about somebody who murdered, it says, "Me'im mizbechitechen lamut." You can even take him away from holding on to the mizbeach. So clearly, Parshat Mishpatim speaks about there being a mizbeach, but it's not just a mizbeach. In also in Parshat Mishpatim, in Perikuf Gimel, it talks about the three holidays during the year. Again, holiness of time. You're gonna, what's gonna happen during this holiness of time? You're gonna come and see me. V'lo yiru panai rekam. You don't come empty-handed. Again, Shlosh Pemi B'Shana Yireh Kol Zechor Pnei Adon Hashem. Look at Pasuk Yutet. Reshit B'Kurei Admatcha, the first fruits, what do you do with them? Tavi Beit Hashem Elokecha. You bring them to a house of God. Which means, if someone is going to try to convince me that prior to the Cheta Ego, there was never a mention of building a house for God with the altar and so on, I would say, you know, excuse me, it says it black and white in too many cases to possibly consider it otherwise. I've said before, and I'll repeat myself, I'm allowed to repeat myself, that I think that when Rashi implies, and there are some others as well, that had there not been the sin of the golden calf, there would not have been instructions to build the Mishkan, I think it's for a completely different reason than we think. It's not because, as some want to explain, because we needed something concrete in order to build, because it's very frustrating and difficult to serve a God who you can't see or feel or touch or kiss or bow down to and so on, and we needed something more concrete. It's not for that reason. It's rather that as a result of the Chet HaEgel, the trip to Israel was stopped. Originally, they were supposed to go directly to Israel, so you don't have to build a temporary Mishkan. You can go directly to Israel and build a permanent Beit HaMikdash, which means it's not because we needed something concrete. The existence of holiness in space, or for that matter, the existence of, or the requirement to build a Mishkan or a Mikdash, or the religious feeling to build it, as we saw by Yaakov, goes all the way back to Sefer Bereshit. It's there in Sefer Bereshit. It is articulated in the Az Yashir. It's there immediately after the Seret HaDibrot. It's there at various times in Sefer Mishpatim. Again, you could try to be very creative and work on each one of these things, but it ends up being the preponderance of the evidence which is here, which just points in the direction that it talks about going to the land of Israel and serving God in the house of God. So what are you talking about? Saying there wasn't supposed to be a house of God? No, there was supposed to be a house of God. There was just never supposed to be a temporary house of God. If you go immediately to Israel, you don't need to build something which is temporary. You go immediately to Israel, then you build something which is permanent. So I'm saying that's the way that I would justify that approach or the linkage between the sin of the golden calf and the Mishkan. I do want to leave you with one teaching, which I like a lot, and I was just trying to figure out when I'll use it, but I'll use it again. If we go back, yes, to source number 8. Source number 8 is almost where the Ramban started today. We read before from Pasuk Hey, I think, Vatayim Shemot Tishmu B'Koli, Ushmartim Et Briti, V'itim Liskula, the covenant, and you're going to become holy. Now that they're holy, again, that's where the Ramban started. Now that they're holy, they need a holy place as well. Now that the Jews have become a holy people, they need a holy place as well. Okay. And that the Ramban worked together with. Now they have the Luchot, they need a place to put the Luchot. The people are holy, they need a holy place. Good. There's actually, it started the verse before. Atem re'item, pasuk dalet. Okay, source 8, perek yud tet, pasuk dalet. This is how the speech actually begins. Atem re'item, asher asiti l'mitzrayim, you saw what I did to Egypt, ve'asa etchem al kanfei nesharim, and I took you on the wings of eagles, vavi etchem elai, and I brought you to me. So now, what does the pasuk really mean? The pasuk really means, okay, before I can tell you, the imagination. What the pasuk really means is that God took them out of Egypt. And he took them out of Egypt, and the first-class treatment, right? They had the Ananei HaKavod, they were taken care of, they were given manna, they were given water, everything they needed, and God says, I took you, you know, on the wings of eagles, and I took you to me. So what does Eli mean in this context? Here, they just got to Sinai, so I took you to me. So where is the holy place? The holy place is Sinai. So as I said, this is as simple as could be. Till we read the Targum Yonatan, which is all the way in source 21. And here is an unbelievable, even delicious fantasy that it understands, the Targum understands in the pasuk. Atem re'itim, you saw, ma'asher asiti l'mitzrayim, what I did to Egypt. V'nasati etchem al ananim, and I took you on the clouds, kimo al kanfei nesharim, which is similar to the wings of eagles, which means, what the wings of eagles, it's saying it's a metaphor. It means that God took us in the clouds. He flew us, right? We were flying in 747s, and where did he take us? Min Ramses, he took us from Ramses. V'hovalti etchem, and I took you, l'makom beit hamikdash, I took you to the Temple Mount, la'asot sham, Pesach. And that's where you celebrated Pesach. Uvahu laila, hashavti etchem l'Ramses. And then I took you back to Ramses. Umisham karavti etchem l'umol Torati. And from there I started to teach you my Torah. Now, there are so many elements In this Targum, again, those of you who don't know, I need to remind you, the Targum Yonatan, or the pseudo-Yonatan, it's not really Yonatan, is not a Targum, it's not a translation. It is a very rich and colorful midrash, which is connected verse by verse. But what did he just say in this midrash? First of all, he says that that night, Pesach night, the Jews were not in Egypt. Pesach night, God flew them first class and took them to Jerusalem, and they all celebrated Pesach in Jerusalem, which of course is where Jews are supposed to be in Jerusalem. I don't know why the Torah Tidbits even advertises the various Pesach vacations outside of Israel. It seems a little, what would the word be?
Over the top.
Distasteful? No, it's worse than distasteful. Okay. What?
Misleading?
No, worse than that. It's much worse than that. It's wrong. Which means Jews, even today when we don't have a temple, should still try to come and celebrate the holidays in Israel, the holidays in Jerusalem. Which, by the way, the only thing worse would be, okay, we're going to have a holiday and celebrate it back in Egypt. Okay, let's go back to Egypt. Let's have a Seder by the pyramids. Okay, that indeed would be worse. But Crete and, okay, whatever.
Not Pesach.
Not Pesach. So where do you celebrate Passover? You celebrate Passover in Jerusalem. Where do you bring the Korban Pesach? Well, Jews always brought in Jerusalem. So what does the Targum Yonatan say? Yeah, of course they celebrate in Jerusalem. There was no temple. There was no Mizbeach. You can't do this in Egypt. Egypt is not a holy place. They did it in Jerusalem. By the way, it's even better than that. He brought them to Jerusalem, but it wasn't time for them to come to Jerusalem, so he brought them back to Egypt, and then from Egypt, then they left. You start thinking a second. Hold it. If they brought them to Jerusalem that night, why not just leave them there? You know, we could have saved 40 years. We could have saved a lot of traveling. We could have saved a lot. But what this midrash is really telling us is something else, at least I think. It's telling us what they experienced. The midrash is trying to describe the experience. The experience of the Jews keeping Passover in Egypt was as if they were standing in the temple. But
yeah, that's what I think about the blood on the
right. Right. They turned the doorpost into Mizbech. They experienced at that point as if they were in Jerusalem, as if they were free people sitting in Jerusalem, their united and permanent capital, and so on and so forth. They were sitting there. They were in Jerusalem that night. But the other thing that it's telling us is that they also identified with holiness of place. Again, they had no holiness of place yet. They were in Egypt at that moment.
Why couldn't they be able to do space? They had holiness of time. They had holiness of object.
To complete the Holy Trinity, as it were. To but that's exactly the point. What's missing, again, you're right. In Egypt, there's holiness of time and there's holiness of matter in terms of the Korban. The only thing missing was holiness of space. But that's exactly what the Midrash. But again, the Midrash is not explaining it literally. I mean, the same way that I can tell you that Sinai is part of Jerusalem, this is even better. Egypt is part of Jerusalem. But of course, Egypt is not... this could cause an international incident right now, if anybody hears it. It's not that Egypt was part of Jerusalem. It's telling you the opposite. It's saying the experience of the Jews at that moment in Egypt is they felt the holiness of space as well, but they felt the freedom and they felt as if they were standing in Jerusalem. And of course, you all understand that's what every Jew is supposed to feel every Passover. They're supposed to feel as if they've left Egypt. Again, think about it. We're supposed to imagine as if we're slaves and then we leave Egypt. They're supposed to imagine that they were slaves and they left Egypt. What's the only problem? They're still in Egypt. So what are they supposed to imagine that they left? So where were they in their minds? They're sitting in Jerusalem. But I'm saying what's fascinating is, no, I brought you to me. What does it mean I brought you to me? It's actually, I brought you to me, I brought you to Jerusalem, to me, and I taught you my Torah. So the link, again, if you notice the words there, I taught you my Torah, which means this then is the linkage between Jerusalem and Sinai. It's not just that Sinai is this first place that the Jews as a people bring an offering. Again, we have the Korban Pesach, and now we have offerings at the foot of Mount Sinai. It's not just the offering, it's the Torah. It's the Kimitzion Teitzei Torah, and that's what it's, that's what this is identifying. I brought you to me and taught you the Torah, which means the laws of Torah the Jews learned in Egypt, it's trying to link it to the holiness of time. Again, you're going to tell me that this is crazy. It's not what it says, it's not what it means. All that's true. But what's the Targum claiming? It's what they experienced.
You can't say that they received their first Torah, not the Jews. So therefore, you
It's not just receiving the Torah. It's experiencing Pesach in Jerusalem, which means which means that what the Medrash is doing over here, it's not just validating what, you know, we imagine truth is historical truth. Truth can also be experiential truth. And experiential truth can transcend historical limitations or geographic limitations. That's what it's trying to say. So as I said, if you were looking for the holiness, you're looking for a place which is holy, the Targum Yonason goes and connects it all the way back to Pesach night. They already identified the holy as well. Okay.